that took your background and also in terms of your experience, what kind of value and expertise you would bring to the CBA if you are successful?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I, by training, am a pharmacist. So I've been involved for the last 7 years on a part-time basis and then further 12 years on a full-time basis at the University of Oregon in the Department of Pharmacy and Pharmacology. And the reason why I got involved in the arena that you're talking about is because I was concerned, having been in practice for 20 years, about the amount of prescription medicine that was being abused and the impact that that was having on households, on people in the home, and the impact that it was having on the youth as well. That has all come to the fore now, because if we have a look at what the United Nations are finding at the moment, is that that is the second fastest growing group of medicines that are of substances that are being abused, second only to marijuana. And that is the expertise that I'm hoping to bring. My research, my involvement at the university has been in preparation of students who are going to be going back into the field and making them aware of the role that they can play in terms of making sure that people are not abusing illicit substances as opposed to the illicit. What we've also come to realize is that there's a movement away from the illicit market towards the illicit market when things get too hot on the street. So a person who might have been abusing the illicit stuff, if they know that they might be caught or they're worried about being caught, they then move over to using things which are of the same family, the opiates in other words, the opium derivatives, but are available in ordinary tablet form on prescription or even without prescription over the counter. So that is where my initial emphasis was and where my initial start was. I then became very, very aware of the fact that if I was talking about that, I needed to also then find out a little bit more about the illicit market as well, because you can't divorce the one from the other. And there's such a correlation between the two. And that got me involved in starting to work, and I developed a program which was called the DrugWise program, which was aimed at teaching all pharmacists in practice and all members of the medical team, being doctors, nurses, as well, on this particular subject, and how, for example, the public will manipulate a doctor in order to get a prescription for betadine, how they will manipulate a doctor in order to get a prescription for sleeping tablets and tranquilizers, and how they will use that as well. So that brought me back to the illicit market as well, and as a result of which we developed a national program which I directed for 8 years or longer. We went into the schools and we educated the children, recognizing that at some stage they're going to be faced with an option to take a drug or not. And the only way that they're going to be able to resist the temptation is if they are forewarned about what the long-term harmful effect is going to be. So by going out with an education program and putting it in such a way that they realize that what we're talking about is not about the immediate gratification that they're going to get from the drug, but rather what the long-term harmful effect is going to be, that maybe that will allow them to make an informed decision as to whether they want to use the drugs or not. And only through education will we be able to prevent them from starting. That now got me to a completely different field now in terms of the research that I've been doing. And that is, why do some people experiment, they take a drug, and then they say, well, if that's what it is, then I'm done. I'm out of here. It does nothing for me. Where someone else takes a medication or takes a drug and says, wow, that was wonderful, I need more. What is it that makes the difference between one person and another person wanting it and another person who's taking exactly the same thing saying, it did nothing for me? So I realized that there was a lot more to it than just what we were always understanding about it. The background, it's your genetic predisposition, all that. There's a lot more to it. And looking at the latest research that is coming out now and getting a better understanding of the effect of the drugs in the brain and how the brain then responds to all of this, having a much better, clearer understanding of where this is all going And that is what will then influence the approach that we need to take in the future in terms of educating the youth in particular, because that's the future that we're trying to protect, as well as people who are involved in terms of where is this all going to lead to at the end of the day. And it's that type of research that is now showing that our thinking was slightly skewed in the beginning. We were just blaming it on the genes. If you have the right genes, that's fine. If you didn't have the right genes, it was just bad luck. It goes much deeper than that, and now this is all coming to the fore as well. So the contribution that I'm hoping to make is in terms of carrying on with my research, carrying on with my understanding of the deeper value systems that have to be changed in order to protect our youth in the first place, to educate them, to be able to make an informed decision at the end of the day, and then, of course, to understand exactly how we're going to protect them. Because they're still going to fall through the cracks. They're still going to be those that unfortunately do fall. And we need to be able to be sure on how to then protect them in the future as well.
Thank you, Honourable Julie.
Thank you so much. I would like to ask a question. One of the challenges in testing of the drugs, which takes too long for the results to be made available. What do you think should be done to speed up the process of testing these drugs?
We understand that there is a problem, and in fact, at the university, we would like to assist. The problem that we have, of course, is the chemicals that we need are all there. The equipment that we need is all there. The expertise that we need is all there. The problem is that the law won't allow us to have illicit substances at the university. But clearly, if we could overcome that, and maybe this is something that we need to work towards, is allowing outside of the forensic departments within the SAPS and within the police to be able to do those tests as well, the universities could assist, and that would speed up the whole process. It would also be a very good opportunity for our development of students in terms of understanding from a forensic point of view of what they're dealing with as well. But clearly, we would have to put a mechanism in place which would guarantee that the illicit substance, if it's found to be illicit, does not get into the wrong hands, and that under controlled circumstances or under controlled conditions that it can be done. I, speaking from my own university, know for a fact that we would be only too willing to assist as long as we as the university would be protected from having the illicit substances in our possession. So clearly, that is something that we could advance, and that would then relieve a lot of the pressure that we have at the moment. And what you're saying is absolutely correct. By the time the results come out, the docket's lost. Yeah. And that's unfortunately the reality that we have to deal with.
Thank you. Matomi, is there a follow-up question? Yes. Honorable Makumini.
Thank you. The idea is more interesting. We're talking about the size of the brain which is the illicit substance, somewhere in the region of 150 billion. Now, that is big. Much bigger than any effort that is put those kind of resources, but the CBA has to try to counter that company without the resources. Do you think that it can be able to do that?
The size and the enormity of the problem is absolutely great. This is the second biggest industry in the world. And of course we know that there is lots of money to be made, and the corporate environment out there have got the resources in which to make it and to make it fly. As much as we could want to wish away that alcohol doesn't appear anymore, it's something that we don't have to deal with, that will never happen either. As much as we would want to get rid of people who promote drinking, such as SA Breweries with their advertising and their promotions and all that sort of thing, that is not going to happen either. So we have to be realistic about the fact that we've got to be very, very careful in terms of what we're actually saying. More importantly, I think that what we need to do is we need to put a mechanism in place where we can control what they are saying as well. I'll give you an example. What I mean by this is, for example, if they say responsible drinking, there is no such thing as responsible drinking. The departure point right from the very beginning is wrong, because there is no such thing as responsible drinking. If you know what alcohol does in the brain, it takes away your ability to be able to be responsible. The very word response able, that's exactly what alcohol does. It takes away your ability to be able to say, I'm not going to have another one, I've had enough already. So there is no such thing as, and I also want to meet an alcoholic who knows when to stop. These are just the messages that they are putting across, and it's not possible. So what we are saying is that as much as we would want to get rid of advertising, as much as we want to get rid of SA breweries, as much as we want to get rid of alcohol, the only thing that we could do is we could dump it in the sea, but then the fish are going to get drunk. So it's also no good. The issue is that we need to be able to control it in such a way. We can't fight it, but we need to be able to control it. The type of messaging that goes out cannot be determined by the breweries. We should be able to determine what the message must be, and measure that and monitor and see what the effect is. In other words, how does the man in the street, the reasonable person, understand that message? Do they clearly understand what the message means to them? Is that what we intended it to be or not? So we need to work. We can't fight against them. They are here to stay, and they will do everything possible to make their business thrive. They're not going to disappear. We need to be able to put mechanisms in place to be able to control the way that they are attracting. It's incongruous to believe that you can advise youngsters to lead a meaningful lifestyle, a healthy lifestyle, by playing sport, and at the same time be promoted by the very people who are destroying them. So those are the sort of things that we should be looking to control and in order to overcome. In answer to the question is, we don't have the resources. What we've got to do is we've got to work with them and control them in such a way that any advertising that they will want to do, because we can't get rid of it, must be done in such a way that we are satisfied with the messaging that is going out, and that we understand exactly what the impact is going to be in terms of what an ordinary visible person on the street would understand by that message. And let us do the measurements, not them. Unfortunately, it's not the way it's happening at the moment. For us, and also if we have a look at what the United Nations have come out with as a directive, education is the only way to try and meet this problem that we have. Again, the education that we need to do is, at the same time, to make the youth understand that these are a harmful effect and a long-term effect. The problem is that when we go to the youth and we say to them, this is not about immediate gratification. This is when we're talking about the problem around substance abuse. It's about the past, the present, and the future. And that wasn't an effort for a bank. The past is where they're coming from. The present is where they are at the moment. But they mustn't only think about that, they must also think about the future. So we've got to educate them about what alcohol is capable of doing with them in exactly the same way. The education process is there for us. We need to work with education departments, we need to work with sports and recreation, and all of those people as well. That comes cheaper than all the other departments are working with us as well. In terms of their contribution, it's not only social development's contribution there. So it
I'm considering the challenges faced by the PTA. I just want to find out if you are appointed a board member, what measures do you think needs to be taken to improve accountability and compliance by both the provinces and the
I think if we need to move into a direction of monitoring and evaluation, and that is clearly the direction that I see that we need to, and it's part of our mandate as well, it would be part of the mandate of the Central Bank Authority in terms of monitoring and evaluation. But we need to be able to work independently. We're not having to worry about what we're allowed to do and what we aren't allowed to do. We have a clear direction in terms of the mandate of what it is that we expect it to do, and that is in terms of monitoring and evaluation. The monitoring and evaluation, following the example of the Public Service Commission, which is what people are going to be using now, that should be adopted by the Central Bank Authority as well. The outcomes being the biggest measure that we should be concerning ourselves with. It's not about how many people did you reach with this message. About how many lives did you save, how many people did you impact on that changed their mind that they wouldn't want to then start drinking or taking drugs and that type of thing. So clearly the monitoring and evaluation is going to have to be a focal point of the Central Bank Authority. The reporting mechanisms that we're going to have to be using would have to be refined, and also that the accountability in terms of ensuring that the reports are received timelessly, that the reports are comprehensive, that everybody is understanding exactly what it is that we as the Central Authority are looking for, are the issues that we would have to make very, very clear. So capacity building, even down to the lowest level, would also then assist us in being able to measure the outcomes of any of the programs that are being done, and of course we will all be on the same page understand exactly what it is.
Thank you. Are you McCarver?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weber, according to that Act, how do you interpret the powers and the functions of the EDA?
My understanding of the mandate of the CDA is, of course, giving effect to the National Drug Master Plan. And if you look at the new Act, Act 17, that's slightly changed where it says the National Drug Master Plan will be advised by or written by the department, but on the advice given by the Central Drug Authority. So clearly, up to the Central Drug Authority to do all of that in that monitoring evaluation and also understanding of what it is that is happening at a grassroots level in order to then influence and guide the National Drug Master Plan, which would then become the department's National Drug Master Plan. So that is the one area. Advising the minister. Here again, if we're talking about advising the minister, we're talking about being aware of what is happening not only locally, but also we have to be really conscious of what is going on around us. Particularly within the sub-Saharan region, our borders, the amount of transport, the amount of cross-border movement that is taking place. We need to be aware of what is happening not only here, but what is happening in our neighbouring states as well. And that means that there's a continuum of research that needs to be done, understanding, talking to our neighbours, understanding exactly what is going on in their area as well, in order for us to be able to advise the Minister appropriately, and then obviously Parliament appropriately, on what measures to be taken. The planning and the coordinating, that is the main function as well. Because at the end of the day, we want every single department that is involved with the Central Drug Authority to be apportioning a certain budget for the fight against substance abuse, understanding exactly what it is within each of the departments that can be done in order to assist. What we need to get everybody to understand is that the substance abuse itself school, failure rate is so high. Do you want to know why absenteeism is so high? Do you want to know why there's gangsterism in the school? There's a common thread running right through. So this is the contribution that you can make as well. But that needs to be coordinated. SAPS would have to be involved in terms of what they're transport in terms of the ground of lives. Not only about alcohol, we want them to be able to look at other things that are being abused that have an effect on their certain ability to be able to drive appropriately as well. So why are we only checking for alcohol as a roadblock? Why are we not looking for other things? Again, making the coordination role that I see and working with all the different departments. So that is the coordination. The summits, the planning of meetings and summits, that is another one of the main functions of the Central Drug Authority. And that again is against conscientize every single person about the size of the problem, making sure that we get the buy-in from all, as we did at the second summit, where we got all the different departments to commit to help, and we've seen the result that it's had. We've seen a far bigger commitment from other departments now in terms of what they are doing to deal with this problem that we are concerned about, which is substance, which is not necessarily their priority, but certainly for us is the priority. So by driving that and the coordination that we're driving, that's where we're seeing a major role for ourselves as well. Then, of course, the other independence is, for me, one of the most important things as well. We need to have the resources, the development, in order to be able to assist at a grassroots level. We talk about the local drug action committees, being the foot soldiers and doing the work at the grassroots level. But the capacity building that needs to take place at that level. Because while they have got the will and the they recognize what the need is, without them, whatever we are doing at a national level is of no value. But we need to help to develop them as well and make sure that the programs that they are running, the programs that they are putting out there, are actually meaningful. And that's again part of the monitoring and evaluation that we are looking at. They need to be able to devise business plans. They need to be able to devise a protocol which will allow them or enable them to resource money. That capacity building, and that is part of the role that you could also assist them with in terms of that. The provincial administrations, making sure that each one of them have got their own master plan, which is aligned to the national drug master plan, and of course then even down at the lower level, ensure that every one of those NGOs have a business plan that we are comfortable with as being meaningful in terms of the type of evaluation that we will be conducting. And then finally, I think what is also very important for the Central Drug Authority is the monitoring of rehabilitation centres in terms of the type of programs that they are running. The registration is part of line function, admittedly. But at the end of the day, we want to also make sure that what they are doing inside their four walls is okay in terms of what we understand as being the needs of the patient as well. And that needs to be an independent, and that's why I say our independence needs to be unsolicited. We must be able to move in and out without worrying about whether we have the right, whether we don't have the right. Working within our framework, working within our mandate, we should be able to move in and out and do exactly what is necessary in order to control the industry as well.
Thank you. Second one? Question?
going to be generated out of sales. So they will do anything and everything possible in order to generate sales. And that's the enticement of people to carry on drinking. At the end of the day, with or without their advertising, people will still drink. Prohibition doesn't work either. And if you have to remove, as I say, if you have to remove the alcohol and dump it in the sea, the only effect would be that it would affect the sea. People will then find something else, the home brews, all that type of thing. So clearly what we're saying is correct. There is no way that we can accept that they should be enticing our youth, number one. The bottom line is, we've got to divorce what is the emotion from the reality. The reality is that we've got scientific evidence to show the harmful effects. That we cannot negate. That we can we can show you scans of the brain that will show you how the brain cells have been destroyed. They can't negate that. They can't shy away from that, because that is stuff that's not anecdotal. This is stuff that we can show you. We can show you exactly the imaging within the brain of the actual damage that has been done. Those are the type of messages that we've got to hop on as well. The fact that they would want to try and negate that, absolutely, we know that that's going to happen. But what we've got to keep coming back with and showing the youth in particular is this is the damage. It goes with the harmful effect in terms of the long term. How many old addicts do you know? People say we don't. You know why? Because they don't live to be old. That's the type of argument that you've got to get back to there. We also understand that no one goes out with an ambition to become an alcoholic. Everyone goes out with an ambition to have a drink, but they're not in control of it. So these are the right type of messages that we have to go out with. And they have to be backed up by scientific evidence, which they then cannot negate. And we've got that. We're just not exploiting it. We're just not pushing it hard enough. That's what we need to do in order to overcome. And of course, they've got the money. We don't have the money. But we've got to rely on that as much as possible.
Thank you. On the other side, I've joined us with Ultimate Network on the Twitter. Is there any questions that you'd like to ask us?
Did you take drugs?
He's always killed that.
I don't have a problem, because if you ask the same question, whenever I go out there and they say to me, have you taken drugs? And my answer to them is, no, I've never taken drugs. And they say, well then how can you tell us what the effect is going to be on us? And my answer to them is, if I have a handful of glass and I ask you to swallow it, broken glass, and I ask you to swallow it, would you do it? And the answer is no. And I say, well why not? Have you done it before? So, we don't have to have swallowed glass to know that it's going to cut our throat when we swallow it. We are capable of understanding and seeing what the effect is without necessarily having had to take it ourselves. I don't have to have been raped to know how dangerous or how bad it is for a person, how emotionally destroying and the trauma that that person must have gone through to have been raped. Our minister of police, head of the police there, I don't have to be a policeman to take the job that I've done either. I don't have to be an alcoholic to own a bar. All of those things. The truth of the matter is, the fact that I haven't taken drugs doesn't necessarily mean that I don't understand what the person has gone through. I can clearly identify with those people with the emotion, having heard and seen, I can tell you exactly how painful it must be. I can tell you exactly how destroying it must be for those people. And we have seen it all the time. We don't have to have taken drugs to know what those drugs.
What's your views on harm reduction?
Unfortunately, harm reduction, I think it's in some ways misunderstood. And particularly when we talk about harm reduction here in our context, we must not allow ourselves to be influenced by anybody else and anybody else's interpretation of harm reduction. Clearly, the notion that it conjures up when we talk about harm reduction is a needle exchange program or allowing a person to carry on using drugs, but not the way they want to, the way we want them to. That's what we've got to get away from. What we need to understand is that If we look at addiction in the first place, this is a mental illness. By definition, by research, we know that addiction is a mental illness. It's also a chronic recurring condition. Being a chronic recurring condition, we need to know that a person with that problem can be controlled. But it's not just controlling. We don't want to allow them to carry on using another drug indefinitely. So if we are going to entertain anything around harm reduction, we've got to make sure, in terms of our South African context, that it's only on one proviso, that abstinence remains the ultimate goal. In other words, we'll use harm reduction if we're going to allow it, but only for a limited period until such time as we can get you off the drug. In other words, let's reduce the amount of harm that the drug is doing for you, to you, and the effect that it's having on you, until such time as you've got it under control, and then we remove it and allow you to remain abstinent. The only way that that will happen, though, is it's not just about medically assisted treatment in terms of harm reduction, but recognizing that there has to be all of the other cognitive therapies brought into the program as well. So if I was to advocate harm reduction in South Africa for us, there would be certain provisions. And the one is, it's not about a needle exchange. It's about assisting a person to be able to withstand the temptation and the relapses until such time as we can control it by giving them cognitive therapy in order for them to withstand the enticements and the invitation to get involved again, and give them the coping mechanisms and the tools with which to be able to survive without using any drug at all. So the ultimate is abstinence. Harm reduction without abstinence is not an option. That's my interpretation.
Just a linked question. If you look at the treatment of heroin addiction, would that be the ideal alternative here for treating heroin addiction and related opiate derivatives?
Unfortunately, if we're talking about heroin and looking at the effect that heroin has and the effect that it has on the brain reward system,
yes,
and the way that the brain reward system is what induces the person to carry on using, the fact that the person could have been off heroin and 6 months later or 6 years later, all of a sudden the cue triggers off the relapse. That's what we've got to understand. This is unfortunately because of the effect that it's having in the brain, the way that the brain responds and the receptors in the brain. That type of illness, the same as a diabetic, needs to be treated with a medicine which happens to be insulin in order for them to be able to carry on. So we would have to treat this person until such time as we can get them to that point. Now, when we're talking about heroin addiction, the problem with heroin addiction is that it's that instant addiction. The one where you don't have a second chance. If you've used it, you're going to be chasing the gun for the rest of your life, and that's where it all comes from. The very nature of the fact that that is a type of addiction that without some form of assistance, that person would not be able to overcome the addiction problem that they have. So we can't deny them some form of treatment, be it medicated or be it whatever other way. But medication on its own is not going to do it for them. We don't allow them to develop the cognitive therapy and the ability to be able to withstand those enticements and all of those areas, then of course it's not an option. So in answer to the question for heroin, that is where I'm afraid is probably the most relevant type of treatment that is available. What I would like to suggest though is, if we are going to look at this as an option, it has to be done by people who are purposely trained to be able to work within that field. We don't want a situation where we have the methadone being used and abused by the patient dealing with a practitioner who can prescribe it for them who doesn't understand what addiction is all about. So in order to be able to use harm reduction and medically assisted treatment, I believe that the practitioner involved must be equipped with the necessary tools in terms of the qualification that they actually then have as a speciality, because this is a specialized field that we're talking about. So it needs to be controlled.
Well, thank you, Mr. Baylor, for that response. It was quite interesting. And I think it was always an interesting and very engaging interview. Thank you very much. They should please come on to your company when you take them.
To a company?
Yeah. Yes? Chairperson for the Portfolio Committee of Social Development. And we call this the panel consists of, should I say, the subcommittee of the two committees of the two houses. So Social Development and the Select Committee on Social Services of the NCAP.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now let me start with a member on my right.
Good afternoon, I'm Mike Waters from the National Assembly. Good afternoon, I'm Mike Waters from the National Assembly. Good afternoon, my name is Bill Fowler, I'm from the National Council of Provinces.
Good afternoon, my name is Chris Poplaiki from the NCAP.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Tabo Makunia from the Port Board of the Port Board of the Port
Board of the Port Board of the Port Board of the Port Board of the Port Board of the
Dr. Rissenberg, could you, let's start this interview by you telling us a bit about yourself, your experience, and if you are to be successful in the candidacy for the CBA board, what kind of innovation and new ideas do you bring to the board? And what do you think of the Central Job Authority currently?
So let me start then by telling you a little bit about myself. I'm a professor at the University of Johannesburg. I have been in
academia. Just interrupt you.
Yes.
You have to address the members, honorable members. That's fine. You don't know that, so I'll teach you something.
Honorable members. So let me start again. I am an academic at the University of Johannesburg. I'm a social worker by profession, and I have been in academia for the past 18 or more years. As a social worker already early on in my career, I had to deal extensively with the problem of alcoholism and drug abuse. At the time, before I went into academia and started doing research in this field, I was a social worker at the Chamber of Mines and then later on with Anglo-American, and in that environment I was responsible for running an outpatient rehab program in the mining industry. And already then I actually developed quite a passion and a feeling for the condition of alcoholism and drugs drug abuse. Since I have been in academia, this interest has actually grown to the extent that at the moment I am involved with the Alcoholics Anonymous South Africa. I'm actually serving on their board of trustees as a non-alcoholic trustee for the past 5 years. And in that capacity, I've been responsible for promoting the activities of Alcoholics Anonymous in South Africa. And that gave me an excellent opportunity to get to know on the ground once more what is the situation of alcoholics out there in society. Furthermore, I've been involved with SANCA, it's a National Council for Alcoholism, since the year 2006. They actually approached me to act as a consultant, a research consultant, and the whole purpose of the research project at that stage was to develop a service quality measure for SANCA. They were interested at the time in measuring or starting to measure their services and the effectiveness of their alcohol, specifically alcohol programs. And in that capacity, I then served as a consultant to develop this tool. This research tool would enable SANCA to measure the effectiveness of its program in terms of the perceptions of patients and clients in their system. And at this point today, we are almost finished. We're actually busy implementing this instrument. So we went through a whole method of developing this tool. We consulted widely with patients, with clients at their centers, with staff members, etc., in order to get to the right items. And today we have a very simple instrument that is currently being implemented countrywide at all the SANCA treatment centers. So I'm very excited about this prospect because I think it is necessary, and that is actually my whole interest in this situation, that we need to know how effective are all these interventions that are being done. And this gave me an opportunity to really contribute to the field of alcoholism to see and to measure whether there is any effectiveness in the kinds of programs that are being implemented. I do realize, however, that measuring outcomes of interventions is a difficult matter, and that there are a number of variables to consider. There are a number of approaches to it. And I would say that the service quality measure that we have got for SANCA now is but one attempt to do that within the local context. So that's really that's been my whole interest in this field, and it has developed from that situation. Another research that I interest that I have is in the development of computerized information systems or IT systems, and how these can be utilized in the field, specifically of social welfare organizations and in the NGO sector per se. And I have already I've been involved also as a research consultant to devise or design and develop an information system for Family South Africa, which is in another field. It's all about families and marital relationships. But the power of this system and the nice part of this system is that it allows the NGO sector, and specifically that organization, to have online access to statistical data, to be able to measure, to be able to report on what are the key functions and key activities in that organization. Currently, I'm also involved with the Medical Research Council, specifically their drug and alcohol abuse unit, and they are also looking at designing and building a service quality measure, which is related to the Sikendu measurement system. And at that organization, I've also been joining as a consultant, and I participate actively in the development of such an instrument. So I think that there is a lot of scope are many limitations. Working with treatment clinics is but one of the areas in which one could introduce measures, and that there are more opportunities within the community. As an academic at University of Johannesburg, we actually support the social development perspective, and a lot of the emphasis of that is to capacitate local communities and develop the people socially as part of an intervention. So treatment facilities, yes, that's one specialized service that is being provided. But my interest is also in devising ways in which we can monitor and evaluate the effectiveness of community-based interventions. To give you an example, a couple of years ago I had a student who did a study in the area of Yutini Dam in KZN. And from her study, it turned out that the locals in that area, so the deep rural area, they used the fruits of a marula tree to create their own drugs, their own home-brewed drugs. And the study was actually not about that, but about how this situation increased the risk for children becoming sexually abused because of the wider exposure that they are in. Numerous factors are, of course, that contribute to that. But that study actually made me realize that we have an informal drug and alcohol situation in the country, within the community system, that probably is far more difficult and challenging to curb and to prevent. So I think there needs to be a lot of research that has to be done specifically on community-based intervention in the field of alcohol and drug abuse.
Okay. Thank you. Honourable Walter.
Thank you, Chair. If I could ask, with regard to the CDA, Central Drug Authority, what are the primary functions and shared responsibilities?
The powers and functions, the way I understand it, the CDA has the function of building policy frameworks, developing interventions, national interventions, promoting legislation, introducing measures, supporting the NGO sector in preventing and dealing with drug and alcohol issues.
Thank you, Honourable Father.
Thank you, Dr. Essenberg. I would just like to know regarding accountability by the CDA. What would you do to ensure CDA accounts for its work?
Honourable members, I think that from my side, I was successful in obtaining this position. One of the mechanisms for ensuring accountability is adequate publication of documentation. So I would definitely be in favor of promoting the publication of documents, and through those formal channels provide the minister with feedback and to be accountable of what should be done. But I think the key is in an adequate volume of publication and documentation for the trial.
Thank you, Honourable Flake. Honourable Father,
there is an outcry that CDA does not have teeth. In fact, in terms of the mandate given to CDA, I would say the mandate is part of the bank not to do certain other things. So I just want to ask you this question. If there is by accident
Honourable Member, I think that giving more teeth is one thing, but in order to use your teeth, you must show them. And that brings me back to evidence-based kind of practice. So if we have research evidence, if we have backup, substantial backup from findings, and we have our ears on the ground and we know what's happening out there, informally, we have a lot of information available. Then we have a foot to stand on to use teeth. So that's what I'm doing.
Thank you, Mr. Honorable Chair. I see that you've been very busy. I couldn't even come. Yeah. And then what you're saying that you know, there is making sure about a marula drink from a student who was studying in the area in Kwazulu Natal and the marula from time immemorial. Has always been used as an
alcohol. Even by the elephant.
Yeah, even by elephants. It will. And then, but there is more, just a small question. What is the committee?
Honorable Member, thank you for asking that question. Do we have a lot of time?
No.
No, Honorable Member, ecometrics is a concept that was derived at the University of Johannesburg. It was actually started by a former colleague of mine who has since left the country, but when he left, the whole field of ecometrics fell to me. And I've actually been instrumental in developing that field within the profession of social work. What it speaks about is the whole issue of measurement and evidence-based practice in social work. What we did is we divide the whole position paper and our professional council and board for social work has adopted this concept. The concept actually promotes the use of evidence for substantiating practice in social work. And our school stands for that, I stand for that, and I believe that that is the key towards successful social intervention. It's one, if you can measure, if you can have evidence for what you are saying, and this evidence is of best practices that are used elsewhere in the world or elsewhere in the country, and if you can use that evidence to plan future interventions, then you have a better chance of succeeding. So, yes, and obviously evaluation of interventions is very much part of ecometrics. So it's that whole field of evidence-based practice, what we would call, that is encapsulated in ecometrics. But it is a local, it's a South African concept, but there is evidence that it is spreading to other parts in the world. So for once we did something new in this country that we take outside.
Thank you. Honourable Member Bruner,
having or being involved in evidence-based research, and according to your experience, what are the key issues affecting family communities regarding drug and substance abuse?
Okay.
Yeah.
Honourable Member, I think there are multiple issues that contribute to families and communities and the drug utilization. I think there are, one should look at it from multiple perspectives. Of course, there are the normal, well-known conditions of poverty that increase the vulnerability of families, for instance. Another area is the availability of drugs. I realize that on a daily basis, if I just listen to my children and I hear how easy it is. My wife, who is a social worker, for instance, she deals with adults of 55 and 40.
So then I realized that availability of drugs and alcohol is one of our biggest problems. It's so informal, it is so easy to obtain, that puts our families and communities into great vulnerability. And then of course, yes, the informal homebrewed drugs, homemade drugs, is an area that is very difficult to control. So I think that the availability is actually my biggest concern. I think that should definitely be addressed. Not only by prevention methods such as better policing or more, you know, in those areas, but also we should actually educate families more actively on the prevention. It's actually sad to see that some children whose parents are addicted to drugs, you know, they are concerned about it, but the parents are seemingly not. So what has gone wrong in society, as far as I'm concerned, that this is possible? You know, the parents need to be educated by the children about drugs. So prevention and active information training in community context is necessary.
Is there any other member that would like to ask any other questions? All fine? All fine. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Rustenberg, for coming. It's been quite interesting. Yes, it has been widely published. Your work has been widely published. And it's quite interesting. So, thank you very much. Do you want to take a body bag from the car?
Mm-hmm.
You're holding it? You want a bag? Okay. Five minutes. Yeah, we only have one. Are you guys questioning?
No, we're not confused whether we need to put
You can go to the lady's sister and find out. It's just a body bag. No, we just want to walk around up the community center. I'm telling you, those touch screens, they look like an easy, doesn't it? Sure. If I want to type K, it makes a catch of the L. Then I'm actually missing that. The funny Nokia. They just died on me. It's an old problem. This is iPhone. Friday. I'm talking about the Thursday. Oh, the Friday.
Yes. Friday proposal that the one that I should be prescribed would also interfere with the tumor.
Yeah, and the Wednesday people?
No, Wednesday people.
I mean the Thursday people?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the Thursday.
That's what you're confusing. So all of them are not available?
Yes.
So they're all not available?
Mm.
Oh.
We're trying to still there for tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's
all busy people. also the name of the person. You should not have given them a choice.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was the approach to create a little environment to respond to interview to most of the
time.
With Skype. And that's the way it's been tried.
Okay. Very good candidate.
Very good candidate.
This chap is very good. But he's a talker, man. Oh, that's it. So he asked me this video. Where am I now? Because I was listening. Ebola is good. But I find Bayeva. He gave me a perspective that they hadn't picked up in England. But I mean, he was a first pharmacologist in England. I was very interested. David Bateman. Very interested. Who is Harry's four tablets? That was green one.
Yeah.
People gave a different one. Yeah, even and Comfort. They say Comfort and Comfort combination. Very good.
Last one.
What? Honourable members, are you ready for the last candidate?
Yes.
Okay. Can we have Dr. De Silva? Welcome, Dr. De Silva. My name is Yolanda Borta. I'm the chairperson for the Portfolio Committee on Social Development in the National Assembly. With me, I have honorable members from the Portfolio Committee of Social Development, but also from the NCOP. And I'm just going to ask them to introduce themselves. So I'll start with the honorable member on my left.
I'm
My name is Harlow Mian. I'm from the Congo, serving the NCOP.
Afternoon, my name is Sipo Plaki. I'm from the Northwest Province. I'm in the NCOP.
Good afternoon, my name is Lawrence Farber and I'm also representing the National Council of Provinces.
Good afternoon, I'm Michael Waters from the NA.
Dr. De Silva, we've received your curriculum vitae, but could you just tell us a bit more about yourself and in terms of your candidacy for the CDA, what experience, expertise, and hopefully some rejuvenation in terms of the CDA or focus, and at least the new focus, would you be able to bring to the CDA? If you are just yes, you can do that little break. Just put microphone on.
Evidence, but knowing that it's important. Thank you.
Honourable Clarkie.
Doctor, there is a motion that says substance abuse is not entirely responsible for all social ills, but rather contributes to the problem. What my question will then be in terms of the broad statement that you said, what would you suggest in CDA, if you are a member, to fight no doping in schools and the entire health problem in the rural community? What would be your program that you would suggest to them to assist the rural community and doping in schools?
What is important is that one has a good understanding of what contributes to certain diseases and what are the consequences. And there is a practical conceptual framework. And I'll explain what I mean by that. Together with social development, provide good insight into that question. Why do I say this? It emphasizes the need for at least attending to three issues. The individual, the drug, plus your environment in which the user and individual live. But most importantly, it says that the one is not the result of the other. They intertwine. It's like the usual three circles that one often sees. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so my suggestion would be we're comprehensively, like Mr. Jay says, in other words, develop programs in the schools or in the rural area that focuses on the drug, what it does, what the risks involved, but at the same time, the new individual develop in them a culture of steering away. But most importantly, also at the same time, looking for what the economic conditions, environmental conditions in the community, but these things have to be addressed in an integrated way. So, when you do research in that area, you have to bear that in mind, set up the focus of all these issues. And they are quite now of looking at, for example, usage and the environment in and see how they put impact on one another. They also put in computer programs to do so. Sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to correct you on that. No problem. I would just like to know what do you see as the powers and functions of the CEA? The primary functions, just in short. Thank you very much.
Its primary function is implement the drug market plan. Do it in a sound way. Monitor that is being done and evaluate whether there's progress. And that's like our research is beginning to be important to get everybody, not only everybody in the country, but I mean government and private, to buy into addressing the issue.
Thank you, Honourable Richard.
Thank you. Doctor, you've mentioned quite a lot of things here today, but often one of the criticisms of the CDA is the fact that they don't have enough authority or teeth, or not taken seriously enough.
That's a big issue.
Yeah. Is that an issue? I appreciate this. How would you, if you were
strong and decisive, right? If you're dangerous in the material community who has even developed an action plan breaking the allegiance. So so goals from the system to do it to following up the plan, but also identify the CDA members have to monitor the program. And if somebody's slipping up, like in countries evaluation, or which is done all the time, but using the corrective the next correction is done with us in time. I would be able to put doctors in the documenting of what is done by who, when, how, etc. And reporting on a regular basis on that for the business.
Thank you. Thanks.
Dr. Sora, I see you have published quite a lot of work and research. I will take you back 90 years. The 1993 research done in Eerste, it was measuring the level of alcohol intake in Eerste, the application of a Kavali alcohol treatment. Maybe in 4 or 5 sentences, tell me what was it all about.
It's the first sort of technique that I developed in on how to measure alcohol use in detail. Looking at the frequency of use, the quantity of use, of what type of beverages.
Mm.
That was done right in the beginning.
And I know Yusuf very well. Is your mic up? Your microphone up? Just tell me what was the outcomes of the research. Just the key points.
We had a good, in other words, understanding of the project. What is used, by whom, in what way. And it's not only the usage, but also the patterns of use.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that comes from very low
response.
Yeah. Citizens follow up, which is very important. If you put that part, when I write the article about it, I just get it to be given an alcohol. I recommend it. But research now, this is what the DDA should be encouraging to follow up to what the water says. That your policy makers, your citizens, they need the project. That we ensure that the research results get implemented.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Paula. It was quite interesting, and I see you really feel a wealth of experience. Thank you very much. I had a caucus with men in the committee. Yeah. And we said, let's look, because there was such a nice flow today of the interview.
just look at scheduling those meetings, those candidates that we had decided, some of them for tomorrow, and then we can finish early on Thursday. So they have been contacted and they're not available. So it looks if we will have to stick to our schedule.
If they could just come earlier, ma'am.
Those for Friday, ma'am.
We don't have anyone for Friday. It's just a Wednesday. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Yeah. So what we can do, I mean, we can only push so that we finish early. We can finish our Thursday in by 1 o'clock.
We have
to
focus on the
Well, if you guys can come from 9 to what time are we starting? What time are we starting?
Tomorrow, 9 o'clock.
No, on Thursday. Yeah, check, maybe with what we can do, we can check whether we... You see, we've been excused from all activities. So maybe you can just sort that out with the chief, because we didn't see.
We don't
start with 18. We can start them at 8, I don't know. All the problem is, can we get those people in? If there's people from Cape Town, let us do this. We'll stick to the Thursday program. If we can get people in that are on the Thursday interview list, that can come in at 8, it means they will have to take the 6 o'clock flight. Oh, no. It's only those that are in Cape Town can come at 8 o'clock. If there's people from the West, okay. If not, we'll just have to go with the team. Okay? Thank you, Oliver. Yes.
The
good fact
is
that 15
years from
all
of us, that we could interview them at 8. Yeah, travel tomorrow.
Oh, good. So let's shut this 8 o'clock. You don't need an application for that. We'll just start the date. Okay? That's that. Thank you.
Great. Kiana Bosson, the question.
Can we be... ready for tomorrow. 6 to 7.
Where's the venue?
It's 6 to 7.
For...
Yeah,
E3 to 7.
Not here.
Right.
We have to apply virtually. This meeting is not sure.